Half past 8.
It's 8:30 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Every week at this time, Lucky Strike throws a conversational party with questions and answers as the main entertainment. Here's how it goes. You furnish the questions and our experts try to answer them. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more, plus a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a Lucky Strike as I present our Master of Ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please has no special rules. As you know, it's a completely unpremeditated and unrehearsed program. Tonight, our board of experts consists first of two of our regulars, the versifier and conning tower man, Franklin P. Adams, and the sports expert and author of The American Sporting Scene, John Kieran. One of our guests is an old friend of Information Please, the author and lecturer, Miss Jan Struther. And our other guest is Joseph E. Davies, formerly ambassador to Russia, and now chairman of the President's Committee on War Relief Agencies, which gives aid to Russia, England, China, and our other allies. Mr. Davies' book, Mission to Moscow, will be published shortly. And ladies and gentlemen, before we begin our questions tonight, we have an announcement to make that's important to all Americans. The Red Cross needs a $50 million war relief fund and needs it now. Give to the Red Cross War Relief Fund through your local chapter. And may we urge that you give at once. Now, we'll start tonight's proceedings with a question from Miss Loretta K. Weiler of Philadelphia. Get 2 out of 3 on this 3-part question. It's about literary chaps all named Tom. Now, what Tom was mortally punished by the villain for not talking? These are all people in fiction. He was mortally punished by the villain of the story because he didn't talk, wouldn't talk. Miss Struther.
Wasn't it Tom Tit, his tongue shall be slit? Little Tom Tit, his tongue shall be slit.
I don't know it. Is it a nursery rhyme? And
yes.
Why was the tongue slit? Sounds as if we're talking too much.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
I'm
yes,
afraid
maybe
so.
We're wrong.
Now, this is an even better known Tom. It's Uncle Tom of the well-known cabin by the same name. Simon Legree, you remember, whipped him to death because Uncle Tom refused to give away the whereabouts of 2 female slaves, I think, that had escaped. Does that come back to you now, Mr. Adams?
Yes, sir.
Got it?
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
We'll mark that one wrong, then. Now, what hero named Tom committed a larceny? Committed a larceny, Mr. Kieran.
The piper's son.
Yes.
Stole a pig and away he run.
That's right. He's a pig stealer. And what one was chased out of a tavern? Chased out of a tavern. This is a Tom in a famous poem. Oh, I think we should get this. It doesn't come to any of you? I went into a public house to get a pint of beer.
Mr. Tommy Atkins.
Tommy Atkins, yes. He goes into a public house, and the publican ups and says, "We serve no redcoats here." I'm sorry that we'll have to get 2 out of 3 wrong on that. That sends $25 to Miss Weiler, plus a set of the encyclopedia. Now, how about this one? This comes from D.P. Liebig of Montgomery, Alabama. You're going to hear 3 scenes in a courtroom rehearsed here for you. What is wrong with each of them? Now, the first scene is a state court in Massachusetts.
The next case is the people of the state of Massachusetts versus John Doe.
John Doe, you are charged with high treason to the people of the United States. How do you plead?
Anything wrong with that? Mr. Davies.
Can't try a federal crime in a state court.
That's quite right. The federal crime in this case is treason that could not be tried in a state court. Very good. Now, the next scene is the United States District Court of the District of Columbia.
Case of John Doe versus United States of America.
Your Honor, my client sustained serious injuries when hit by a United States mail truck and asks for $50,000 damages.
Mr. Davies again.
All suits against the United States have to be brought in the court of claims.
You can't sue the United States at all, then. That is in the
ordinary... You can on contract, but not under tort.
I beg pardon?
You can for contract, but not for wrongs called tort.
I see. I wouldn't ask you to explain them, Mr. Davis.
Is there anything like malfeasances?
Quite right.
No, Pollock on torts.
Our eminent legal student, Mr. Adams, helping you out, Mr. Davis. Yes, an action of this sort must be filed, as Mr. Davis reminds us, with a court of claims.
I was still right, despite Mr. Adams.
Good enough. Now, the next scene is the lower criminal court of the state of Maryland.
George Punevich, step to the bar. You are charged by the town of Bethesda, Free State of Maryland, with exceeding the legal and maximum speed limit of 30 miles an hour. How do you plead?
I claim diplomatic immunity because of my attachment to the Bulgarian consulate in the city of Annapolis.
I fine you $10.
How about that? Mr. Davies.
What is wrong about that?
Well, or what is right with it? Is the fine correct? Is the judge within his rights in overriding Mr. Punovich's claim for diplomatic immunity?
The court is wrong.
Why is the court wrong?
Because as a matter of international comity, a diplomat cannot be convicted of a crime in a state court.
Diplomatic what? What rank?
Oh, I guess I'm wrong.
Ah, that might be so. That's happened even to diplomats before, David. In this case...
Yeah, I know. I've been there.
Now, in this case, Mr. Davies, the diplomat is a consul. He's a diplomatic consul in the city of Annapolis. Is he immune from prosecution?
No, he is subject to the laws of the state. It's only the personal representative of the government who is the head of the mission that is entitled to diplomatic immunity.
That is exactly right. In other words, the ambassador or the public minister, and I understand his domestic or domestic servants are also
anyone
immune.
In his habitat or his home.
I see.
Right.
Was that true for you when you were in Russia, Mr. Davies?
Oh, definitely, sir.
Do they have the same system over there?
Oh, it's a matter of international comedy. Russia is very decent about that.
Very good. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3 at least, or 2.5 out of 3 if we accept Mr. Davies' emendation. Now, how about this one from R.T. Lang of Kittenning, Pennsylvania? Get 2 out of 3. What did each of these carry? William Dawes, D-A-W-E-S. Mr. Adams.
William Dawes was the Paul Revere pal.
Yes, right. And what did he carry then?
He carried a lantern.
Well, I don't think he carried a lantern. He might have.
On tour by sea.
Well, wasn't that... Well, Mr. Kieran, wasn't that the signal? Well, he carried a message, Mr. Adams. That's what you really mean. He carried the same message that Paul Revere did, that the English were coming.
And a lantern.
And did he carry a lantern too, Mr.
Adams? Yes, Reed? Paul Revere did, didn't he? And so did that other guy in Greece.
Who carried it on? Diogenes?
Yeah, didn't he?
Right, he did. That's quite true. It's a little remote.
Didn't Paul Revere have a lantern, too?
I believe Paul Revere had a lantern. And what other, beside Dawes and Revere, carried the same message to every Middlesex village and farm? There were 3 messengers. The other was Prescott. And the only one of these 3 that we remember is Paul Revere because of Mr. Longfellow's poem. Now, what
4 of them.
Were there 4? You know, things are getting kind of
Paul
crowded.
Paul Revere's horse. Adam.
Mr. Adams is always very kind to dumb animals on this show.
He has a horse on Paul.
What did each, what did Aeneas carry? Aeneas, Mr. Kieran.
Carried his father, Anchises,
yes,
on his back.
On his back, out of...
Being a pious man.
Burning Troy. And Rosinante carried... Miss Struther?
Don Quixote, or Quixote, or however you like to pronounce it.
How do you like to pronounce it?
I like Don Quixote myself.
Okay, we'll make it Don Quixote. Rosinante, of course, was...
What?
Mr. Adams' favorite animal. It was the horse of Don
Quixote. Oh, yes, Quixote. Yes. I thought that was...
That gives us 3 out of 3. Good. Dorothy Kickhafer of Kew Gardens sends this one in. Identify these contemporaries. The first is a Russian with an English wife. A Russian with an English wife. Mr. Davies.
Mr. Litvinov.
Yes, Mr. Litvinov, here on a mission from Russia. Identify a Japanese with a German wife, which seems like a very well-suited couple. A Japanese with a German wife. Famous contemporary. For not too long a time, we'll hope. That would be Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo of the land of the so-called Rising Sun. What contemporary is a Chinese married to a Wellesley graduate? Mr. Kieran.
General Kai Chek.
Yes.
Whatever his name is.
Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek married one of the famous Song sisters. Now, that gives us 2 out of 3. How about this one from Barbara Easley of New York? Again, get 2 out of 3 if you can. This is a poetry question. I'm going to ask you to recite a line or lines of poetry about first a gate, then a door, and finally an exit or exits. Let's have a line of poetry about a gate.
It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with circumstance the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of myself.
That's peachy. That's very good, Mr. Davies. Very good. One word wrong in that.
How punishment.
Punishments, as Mr. Adams reminds us. Mr.
You want Kieran? A door?
I love a door.
There was a door to which I found no key. There was a veil through which I could not see, and so forth, from the Rubaiyat.
Ah, that's a very unfamiliar one, Mr. Kieran. Mm. Very good. When you say and so forth, of course, you assume that I know how it goes on. You're wrong. And now, finally, a line of poetry about exit or exits. Miss Strubber.
We have our they have their exits and their entrances.
Yes, a very good line. From what play of Shakespeare's is that?
Hamlet, All the World's a Stage.
No. It's not, Mr. Kieran?
As You Like It.
It's from As You Like It, yes. Sounds sort of Hamlet-ish, but it's from As You Like It. Does that surprise you, Mr.
It surprises me a great deal.
Well, Mr. Kieran's right.
Shatters me.
That gives us 3 out of 3. Now, how about this one? This is from Ernest Butt of Flushing, New York. Again, get 2 out of 3. It's a sports question. What sports event takes place annually between the following locations on the map? From Hopkinson to Boston. A sports event taking place between Hopkinson and Boston. Mr. Kieran.
Well, I don't know what Hopkinson is, but I suppose that's the Boston Marathon, isn't it?
That's right. I suppose Hopkinson is a town sufficiently far from Boston
this
to make the Boston Marathon possible.
Hopkinson.
You'll probably hear from Hopkinson in the morning, Mr. Kieran. How about Putney to Mortlake? Putney to Mortlake, Miss Strother.
The Oxford and Cambridge boat race.
Yes, the famous Oxford and Cambridge
boat race. The
boat race. I beg your pardon. As an Englishwoman, I'm entitled to be specific if I want to.
From New York to Bermuda. New York to Bermuda, Mr. Kieran.
I think it's off this year. There's a yacht race from... London to Bermuda.
No, there is
a yacht race.
Yacht races from both places, I think.
Sure. They do have it, however, from New York to Bermuda also.
Safe bet nothing else could be but a yacht race from New York to Bermuda.
Yes, you couldn't very well have a marathon.
It might be a plane race.
True enough. Do you say that's off this year, Mr. Kieran?
I think most ocean yachting is off.
I imagine so, yes. Well, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out $25 and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and now Mr. Cross points out that when it comes to Gilbert and Sullivan, nearly anyone can quote a few lines, but it takes an expert like Mr. Adams to repeat whole stanzas.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, expert knowledge makes a big difference when it comes to cigarettes, too. For in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. And when a man knows tobacco, he knows cigarettes. Now, the South's independent tobacco experts spend their lives buying, selling, and handling the leaf. So their overwhelming preference for one cigarette, Lucky's, means a lot. Let me just give you an example of what they see at auction after auction. In Goldsboro, North Carolina this season, the American Tobacco Company paid 29% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 29% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. The result is Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. And that's why, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Mr. Fadiman, isn't that a good reason for trying the tobacco expert cigarette?
Yes, Mr. Cross, you've shown us both the reason and the advantages, and in just 59 seconds. Now, how about this one from Verda Zimmerman?
Thank God for the profit motive in advertising.
This one from Verda Zimmerman of Omaha, Nebraska. I'm going to ask you to supply the missing characters in these scenes. I'll describe each one. The first scene is a tea party. We have the Mad Hatter, the March Hare, and Alice. Who's missing from the tea party? Mr. Kieran.
Dormouse.
Yes, so the Dormouse. So the Dormouse doesn't do very much to help things along.
He sleeps.
He's what we might call a frank guest instead of the ones who are less frank at tea parties and keep awake when they need him. How about this one? There's a commission meeting in Washington, and you see at the commission meeting Mr. Ed Hurley, Mr. William I. Harris, Mr. Joseph E. Davies. One missing, Mr. Davies.
Guilty.
A big
Federal Trade Commission.
Who was that?
The Federal Trade Commission.
That was the Federal Trade Commission. Who's the guest that's missing from the quartet?
George Rubley.
Well, now, my information may be wrong. This is 1914. Would that be right?
1914.
You remember at that time.
William H. Perry, would that be?
Perry of Seattle.
Yes, that would be quite right. Well, your memory does go back quite a long way, Mr. Davis.
Unfortunately.
How about this? Now, there's a banquet set for three. It's prepared by Esther, for King Ahasuerus and what other guest? Now, we are here in the Old Testament, of course. Banquet is set, Mr. Adams?
Haman.
Haman is right. Haman, yes. You hang as high as Haman. Very good. Thank you. Now, how about this? Mrs. Lillian F. Owen of Portland, Oregon, sends this one in. What was the occupation of the person referred to in each of these quotations? Get two out of three. Here's the first quotation. A man he was to all the country dear and passing rich with 40 pounds a year. What's his occupation? Miss Strother, was that your hand, Mr. Kieran?
No, no.
That's from Oliver Goldsmith's deserted village. And I think he was the schoolmaster.
No.
Ronnie's the preacher.
That's quite right. He was the parson. I wish I hadn't heard you say the schoolmaster, Mr. Kieran.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got a mixed up.
You meant the parson. How about this one? The emptiness of ages in his face and on his back the burden of the world. Mr. Kieran.
He was an agricultural worker.
He wouldn't have known
much of a man. The man with the hoe.
Yes, the man with the hoe.
Edwin Markham.
Quite right. Edwin Markham's famous poem. Now, how about this occupation? Peeping through keyholes, running after fire engines like a lot of coach dogs, waking people up in the middle of the night to ask them what they think of Mussolini, a lot of Daffy Budinskys swelling around with holes in their pants, borrowing nickels from office boys. What are these people? Any idea? The quotation rings no bell, Mr. Adams?
No bell whatever. This communist.
Heavens, no. Goodness gracious. In that case, Miss...
They wouldn't be field workers for the Gallup poll, would they?
Sounds as if they would, no. Mr. Davies, I wish you hadn't said fifth columnist, because there are... Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran are both journalists, and the reference in the quotation is to journalists. And I can assure you...
In what work?
In the front page by Hecht and MacArthur. Well, still no, you didn't get it. Shall we call that wrong, Mr. Kieran? Shall we accept
it wrong? I'd call it wrong and
send $25. Unjust. Send $25 to Mrs. Lillian Owen and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. How about this one from Mrs. Hilda R. Stice of Urbana, Illinois? Get two out of three. What men currently hold the offices that were previously held by the following? Held at one time by William Phillips. What office is now held by, what person now holds that office? Yes?
Sumner Wells.
Sumner Wells. And what office is it?
Undersecretary of State.
Undersecretary of State. Walter F. George. Well, who holds his job now? Mr. Davies again.
Tom Connolly.
Connolly. And what is the office?
Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate.
Yes, and very important job. And Sam D. McReynolds. Sam D. McReynolds.
Sam.
Mr. Strother and gentlemen, you're letting Mr. Davies do all the work.
Well, you're having a lovely time.
Sam D. McReynolds?
Sam D. McReynolds.
Well, you did very well. We have two out of three. We're safe. That's the job now held by Mr. Saul Bloom, Chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Mr. Saul Bloom. All right, how about this? From Edmund Hutchinson of Washington, D.C. Name three instances in which a lamp or a lantern figured prominently in either fact or fiction. Mr. Kieran.
Aladdin had a very good lamp.
Yes, a very good lamp. Miss Strother.
Florence Nightingale had a ditto.
Had a equally good lamp, perhaps even more useful. And Mr. Adams, you had your hand up?
Well, it isn't fiction exactly, but
no, it can be fact.
There's Paul Revere.
Oh, heavens, can't
forget for that.
I see that you and Mr. Davies are cooperating on Paul Revere. Mr. Kieran?
I have another one isn't fiction, the Statue of Liberty.
It's a torch, perhaps, rather than... Well, I guess that would be considered a lamp or lantern.
A lamp unto my feet.
Yes, true.
What about Wee Willie Winkie?
Did he have...
Runs through the town, you know?
Yes, and what did he...
He lit the lanterns. Maybe he just had a taper. That wouldn't
He had a lamp lighter, but didn't have a lamp. There was a lantern that was kicked over by Mrs. O'Leary's cow, a very famous lantern. Mr. Davies, were you going to give us that one?
Well, it came back to me.
Well, that gives us three or four famous lamps or lanterns. Now, how about this from Marion Fisher of San Diego, California? Get two out of three. From these descriptions, can you name these prominent men? Now, the first one was born in Germany, became a senator from Missouri, and helped elect Lincoln. Who was that, Mr. Adams?
Carl Schurz.
No question. Carl Schurz. Very good. Now, this one was born in England, settled in New York, and became a trade union leader. Who was that? Mr. Kieran.
John L. Lewis.
I think not.
Green.
I beg pardon?
Green.
Green. Did he settle in New York?
AFL.
I'm not sure. My answer is Samuel Gompers.
Right. Yes, not,
I think I think,
I think
I'm
Green's
right.
An Englishman also.
Yes, I do think so. Mr. Lewis,
Lewis
is a Welshman.
Mr. Lewis is a Welshman.
Green is a Welshman, too, in part.
Is he? They said so? Well, were they both born in Wales, or were they born here? Do you remember?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure.
Mr. Lewis was born in Wales.
He was born in Wales. I don't know whether he settled in New York. He now seems to be settled in Washington. can you name one who was born in New York and became premier of a foreign republic? That's a tough one.
No, that's very easy.
For you?
De Valera.
De Valera, yes. Very good. Well, I don't think most of us would have remembered that, Mr. Kieran, that Premier De Valera was born right here in New York. That gives us 2 out of 3. Now, how about this? From Gene Lyman of San Diego, California, also. Name a book written for children by each of these authors. Now, the first is Charles Dickens. Now, be careful. A book written for children by Charles Dickens. This is a tricky one. Mr. Adams?
A Child's History of England.
That's very good. Most of the books that we think of as being written for children, such as A Christmas Carol, were, of course, written for everyone. Child's History of England. Not a very good book. I think it was Chesterton who said that it was not so much written for children as written by a child. Charles Kingsley wrote a book for children. Mr. Kieran?
Water Babies.
The Water Babies. John Ruskin wrote a book for children. Mr.
Beautiful.
Kieran again.
King of the Golden River.
Did I hear...
Wonderful story.
A plug, eh?
Yes.
John Ruskin, the King of the Golden River. That's quite right. A very good story. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, on our side of the water. Miss Struther.
Tanglewood Tales.
Tanglewood Tales. Have you read them?
Oh, yes. I was brought up on them.
Tanglewood Tales and the Wonder Book.
And, yes, both adapted from Greek mythology, I believe. That gives us 4 out of 4. Here's one from Betty Edward of Milton, Massachusetts. I like this one. Get 2 out of 3. What's the difference between, or shall we say among, biscuit, muffin, and bun? Biscuit, muffin, and bun. I want precise answers. Miss Struther.
No, I was just scratching my right ear because all those words mean something different here from what they do in England, so I'd better
a
not
A biscuit
discard.
Would be your cracker.
That's right, and your cracker would, I mean, what we call a cracker would be what you call a snapping motto.
Also, we would.
Yes.
I have never been more
fun
confused in my life.
Cracker the next morning.
Now, if you are through with your snapping mottos, Miss we will endeavor to find out what, in this country, a biscuit, a muffin, and a bun mean. Now, come, come, gentlemen. What is a biscuit? Mr. Adams.
A biscuit is something that you put in the oven.
Not permanent.
Made out of dough.
Yes, yes. That's safe enough.
That's all I know. Very good with butter.
Miss Struther?
It rises to about 8 times its normal size under the influence of heat in the oven.
Not only under the influence of heat, but what else is put into it?
Baking
to make
powder.
It?
Baking powder.
There we are, Mr. Davies. Now you have it. Baking powder. That's quite right. That's what gives a biscuit its peculiar property. It's a small loaf or cake of bread raised or shortened or made light with baking powder. Now, how about a muffin? A muffin differs from a biscuit, sometimes violently. What is a muffin? Any idea?
I don't know. I had one for breakfast.
I think it's the same thing without the baking powder, and it's much heavier, and it sometimes has blueberries in it.
It's generally toasted.
Often toasted, as Mr. Davies reminded.
Well, that's an English muffin.
But it's made with some particular, just as we put soda or baking powder into a biscuit, we put what into a muffin, always?
Yeast.
No, no. Be quiet, Mr. Adams.
To have dough.
Yes, of course.
We all have.
It's made with eggs. Made with eggs. At least that's what it says here. Miss Struther, isn't that true? Do you make muffins with
maybe,
eggs?
Maybe. I always just buy them at a drugstore.
Well, even so, they're made with eggs originally. Now, Mr. Adams, that muffin you ate this morning is made with
English
eggs.
Muffin you're speaking of.
Coffee and toasted English. That's what I asked for.
I'll call the muffin wrong and tell me now what a bun is. A bun.
No quotes.
I beg pardon?
Bun, no quotes.
Bun, no quotes.
You don't mean a twist of hair at the nape of the neck or anything
no,
like that?
No, not that sort of bun.
No, hot cross.
Oh, hot cross.
Not the kind of bun that Mr. Adams is more familiar with. No ideas, gentlemen?
Well, it's made out of something like the same material that goes into bread.
Yes?
Soft stuff.
But what's its main characteristic?
It's a small loaf of bread.
Well, not a loaf, Mr.
Well,
Davies.
No, but it's
you
a
put
small.
Yeast in it.
You do what?
Put yeast in it.
You might do that.
It's
but
a miniature. It's a miniature loaf.
Oh, but the important thing about a bun is that it's what?
Sugared.
Oh, of course.
Oh.
Well, there you see.
Oh, you knew that all along, Mr. Kieran.
And slightly inedible.
Oh, no, no, no.
They're perfectly edible, but not digestible.
Parts of it are very good sometimes. It has a glazing of sugar, milk, and spice on the top crust generally. It's a kind of cake or bread. I don't think I should give you full credit on that. Would you say so, Mr. Davies?
I should say we lost on that.
I think you all did very badly. Miss Struther, if I should now ask you what the difference is in English, in England, would you be able to...
It would take too long, I think.
Take too long? All right. Suppose I send $25 and a set of the Britannica, then, to Miss Betty Edward of Milton, Massachusetts. Biscuit, muffin, and bun. Now, by this time, I'm quite confused myself and couldn't tell the difference in any circumstances. Well, let's see. We seem to have finished all the questions at my disposal, and now Mr. Cross tells us of an encounter he had recently with a young gentleman just out of college.
Well, Mr. Fadiman, he had majored in economics at college, so he was very interested in our comments about advertising on this program, particularly the fact that if we did no advertising at all, the price you pay for a package of Luckies would not be reduced one iota. Mr. Cross, he said earnestly, I learned something from your program I didn't learn in college. Well, ladies and gentlemen, surprising as it may seem, the total cost of all our advertising activities is such a small fraction of a cent per package that if it were entirely eliminated, the saving per package could not be passed on to you. The makers of Luckies have always believed that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. The tobacco, not the advertising. And we consistently pay what it costs to get the milder, better-tasting tobacco for Luckies. For instance, this season at Oxford, North Carolina, we paid 25% more than the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. 36% more at Dillon, South Carolina, and so on, all over the South. Yes, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Why not make your next package Luckies and prove to yourself that it's the tobacco that counts?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out $75 and three sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Miss Strella. Thank you, Mr. Davies, for coming to Lucky Strike's party tonight. Now, next week, that dependable trio will be back, Mr. Franklin P. Adams, Mr. Oscar Levant, and Mr. John Curran. And our guest will be the world-famous journalist, John Gunther, presently returning from England. Now remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. And if the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to us at Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now we'll listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
When you hear that chant, ladies and gentlemen, remember that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts, and Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. By the way, have you seen the new Lucky Strike gift chest? 500 Luckies in flat 50s and 20s, packed in a handsome natural grain sycamore chest. It's an ideal Christmas present for anyone you specially want to please. Ask to see it tomorrow at your favorite cigarette counter.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.